A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know that feeling when you walk out of a museum and realize you spent $17 to learn less than you knew when you walked in?
I know exactly the face you're making right now. It's the same face I made at the Vent Haven Museum in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky.
The what now?
The world's only museum dedicated to ventriloquism. Hundreds of dummies in glass cases. All staring at you. The curators are deadly serious about the art form's history. And you're standing there surrounded by 400 unblinking faces thinking, this is someone's life's work.
That's actually the perfect entry point for what Daniel's asking about this week. He sent us a whole thing about the world's worst museums, and he's very specific about what he means. He's not talking about ironic novelty places or museums that are deliberately absurd. He wants the institutions that were built with total sincerity, preserving history, educating the public, celebrating a local industry. And visitors walk out thinking, that was painfully boring and terrible.
Earnest failure. That's the category.
He wants to know what makes a museum genuinely terrible. Is it the subject? The presentation? A lack of interesting objects? Misleading publicity? Excessive seriousness? Or is it the gap between what the museum thinks it's offering and what visitors actually experience? And he wants concrete examples. Places where the curators believe they're doing important cultural work while the audience checks their watch.
And the key distinction he's drawing, which I love, is that the humor has to come from the sincerity. These aren't places trying to be funny, they're trying to be important. And they're failing so earnestly that you can't look away.
So we're walking through the hallowed halls of the world's most disappointing museums. And trust me, the exhibits aren't the only thing that's flat.
Before we get to specific disasters, we should define what we're actually talking about. A museum can fail in a dozen different ways. Bad lighting, confusing layout, text panels that read like a doctoral dissertation printed on a wall. But the core failure, the thing Daniel's really poking at, is something deeper.
The sincerity gap?
These are institutions that believe deeply in their own mission. They're preserving something they think matters. And the visitor stands there thinking, does it though?
There's a difference between a museum that's niche and a museum that's bad. The Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles is deeply weird, but it's deliberately weird. It's playing with the form. What Daniel's after is the museum that has no idea it's weird. The one where the curator would be hurt by your reaction.
And that's where the data gets interesting. Radical Storage, which is a luggage storage company of all things, published a survey in 2025 that analyzed over 100,000 reviews of major museums worldwide. They ranked them by what they called a disappointment ratio.
A luggage storage company did this.
A luggage storage company. I'm not going to pretend that's not funny, but the methodology is actually sound. They scanned reviews for words like boring, overrated, disappointing, not worth it, and calculated what percentage of total reviews contained those terms. It's a sentiment analysis, not a quality judgment, but it captures something real.
The gap between what you expected and what you got.
And the museum that topped the list is surprising. The Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. 22% disappointment rate, the highest among the 20 ranked museums.
The Air and Space Museum. The one with the actual Apollo capsules and the Wright Brothers plane.
That's the one. And that's what makes it such a perfect case study. You walk in expecting to be awed, you're going to see the machines that left the planet. The artifacts of human beings who climbed into metal tubes and pointed themselves at the moon. And then you get there and it's exhibits that haven't been updated since the 90s. Long lines for everything. The spirit of Saint Meg Zand. Louis hanging from the ceiling, which is incredible, but it's been hanging there since 1976 and the presentation hasn't changed.
So the subject is literally the most exciting thing humans have ever done, and the experience is flat.
That's the expectation mismatch. It's the core failure mode. The more iconic the subject, the wider the gap when the presentation underdelivers. You don't walk into the National Mustard Museum expecting transcendence. You walk into the Air and Space Museum expecting to feel something about what it means to be human. And when you get a tired, overcrowded building with static displays and a gift shop that's been picked clean by school groups, the disappointment is proportionate to the expectation.
The second most disappointing on their list was the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana. 21% disappointment rate.
And that one hurts me personally because I love dinosaur museums. The Museum of the Rockies has one of the largest collections of dinosaur fossils in the world. It's got the largest Tyrannosaurus rex skull ever found. It should be thrilling. But it's in Bozeman, which isn't exactly a casual drop-in destination. You're making a trip for this. And visitors report dated exhibits, limited interactivity, and a sense that the collection is incredible, but the presentation hasn't kept up.
So you drive hours to see the greatest dinosaur collection on Earth, and you get a series of glass cases with bones in them.
And labels. So many labels.
The subject isn't the problem. That's the thing Daniel's question gets at, and it's worth saying plainly. Dinosaurs aren't boring. Space flight isn't boring. Mustard might be boring, but even mustard can be interesting if you present it right.
The National Mustard Museum in Middleton, Wisconsin is actually a fascinating borderline case. It started as a sincere collection. The founder just really loved mustard, collected thousands of mustards from around the world, wanted to share that passion. And now it's this strange hybrid where visitors show up for the kitsch factor, but the curators are trying to educate you about mustard history. There's a mustard tasting bar. There are exhibits about mustard in ancient Rome. The tension between what the institution thinks it's doing and what visitors are actually there for is the whole experience.
I've been. The mustard tasting bar is the only part anyone remembers. The rest is a lot of reading about emulsification.
And that's the trap, the local pride trap. Small museums dedicated to a single subject, barbed wire, pickles, mustard, ventriloquism, often assume the subject's importance is self-evident. The curator has spent 40 years thinking about barbed wire. To them, every gauge and twist pattern tells a story. But they never translate that passion for an outsider. They just present the objects and expect you to feel what they feel.
It's the difference between knowing something matters and making someone else feel why it matters.
That's beautifully. That's exactly it. And it connects to something else in the survey data. The phrase that kept showing up in negative reviews, "Was it worth it?" Not I. Didn't learn anything. Not the subject is dumb. It wasn't worth it. Which means the visitor is making a value calculation. They paid admission, they spent time, and they're judging the return.
And museums hate that framing.
Of course they do. They're educational institutions, not theme parks. But the visitor is standing there with a ticket stub and 2 hours of their life they can't get back. They're going to make the calculation whether the museum wants them to or not.
So, let's talk about the knock-on effect. The ways this plays out beyond just a bad afternoon. Because Daniel's asking what makes these places fail, and I think there's a taxonomy here.
Go on.
You've got the expectation mismatch we already covered. The Air and Space Museum problem. But there's also what I'd call the mausoleum effect. Museums that are so reverent, so hushed, so wall-to-wall with text panels, that they kill any sense of discovery. You're not exploring. You're being lectured at by a building.
The opposite of Disneyfication. No interactivity, no narrative, no sense that a human being curated this with an audience in mind. Just objects and cases and paragraphs on walls, and the assumption that the objects speak for themselves.
They don't. Objects are mute. A rock is a rock until someone tells you it's from the surface of Mars.
There's a museum in... I'm trying to remember the name. It's a medical history museum in Minneapolis. The Museum of Questionable Medical Devices. And it's an interesting case because it walks the line between ironic and earnest. The collection is real. Phrenology machines, vibrating chairs that were supposed to cure hysteria, devices that claim to measure your personality through your skull. The curators are serious about preserving medical history and showing how quackery operated. But the subject is inherently absurd, and visitors laugh. The curators aren't trying to be funny. They're documenting a genuine historical phenomenon. But you're standing in front of a machine that was sold as a cure for cancer in 1920, and it's a wooden box with a light bulb in it.
And that's the thing Daniel's really after, I think. The humor that comes from watching an institution take itself completely seriously while the audience is silently losing it.
The excessive seriousness failure. It's a real category. Museums that over-curate to the point where the experience feels like a test you didn't study for. Every object has a 40-line label. Every room has an introductory panel and a concluding panel and contextual panels in between. By the third room, you're not looking at the exhibits anymore. You're just trying to survive.
I went to a museum once. I won't name it. The curator was very nice. Where the first room had a 45-minute video you were supposed to watch before entering the exhibit. 45 minutes. Just to understand what you were about to see.
What was the subject?
Local agricultural implements.
45 minutes.
I watched 12. And I'm a sloth. I'm patient by design.
The misleading publicity angle is another failure pattern that the survey data captures well. Museums that promise interactive exhibits or world-class collections and deliver a few glass cases and a laminated map. The marketing sets expectations the building can't meet, and then the not-worth-it reviews pour in.
It's a promise problem. If you tell me I'm going to experience the wonder of flight, and I get a room full of model airplanes behind plexiglass, you broke a promise. If you'd told me it was a room full of model airplanes, I might have been fine with it.
The Museum of the Rockies doesn't promise to be a dinosaur theme park, but it's got the largest T-Rex skull in the world. That fact alone creates an expectation. You can't unpromise the largest T-Rex skull.
So where does that leave us? The worst museums aren't the ones with boring subjects. They're the ones that fail to bridge the gap between their own sense of importance and the visitor's need for engagement. The humor comes from watching an institution take itself so seriously while the audience checks their watch. And the specific flavor of that humor, the thing that makes it different from watching a bad movie, is that the museum doesn't know it's failing. The movie knows it's bad on some level. The director saw the dailies. The museum curator has been there for 30 years and still believes deeply in the importance of the barbed wire collection.
That's the earnestness. It's the secret ingredient. A bad movie can be cynical, shot cheap, released fast, nobody cared. But a bad museum is almost never cynical. Someone cared enormously. Someone devoted their life to this. And the result is still a room full of dummies staring at you.
The Vent Haven Museum.
I can't overstate how unsettling that place is. 400 ventriloquist dummies. Some of them are 100 years old. They're arranged by era. There's a whole section on the golden age of radio ventriloquism. The curators are preserving an art form that most people have never seen performed live. And you walk through these rooms and every single dummy is looking at you with its painted eyes and its frozen wooden grin, and you think, someone dusts these.
Someone dusts each individual dummy.
Someone has a schedule. Tuesday is the radio room. Wednesday is the television era, and they do it with reverence.
That's not a failure of curation. That's a triumph of curation applied to a subject that can't support the weight.
And that's the question, isn't it? Is any subject too small for a museum? I don't think so. I think the Vent Haven Museum is fascinating precisely because of the gap between the curator's seriousness and the visitor's reaction. It's not a bad museum in the sense of being poorly done. It's a museum that creates an experience the curators didn't intend.
The unintentional art piece. The museum has found comedy.
Which brings us to something Daniel didn't ask directly, but I think is lurking in the question. Is there a museum so bad it's good? The way there are movies so bad they're good? Or is the earnest failure of a museum always just sad?
I think it's different from movies. A bad movie you watch passively. A bad museum you have to walk through. You're physically present. You made a trip. You paid admission. The commitment changes the emotional register. It's harder to enjoy ironically when you're standing in a dim room in Bozeman realizing you have 2 more hours of dinosaur bones to look at.
The physicality of it. You can't fast forward.
You can't check your phone the same way. You're trapped in the experience. And that's part of why the disappointment registers so strongly in those reviews. It's not just, I didn't enjoy this. It's, I'm still here.
Before we wrap, Hilbert has a bone to pick with our whole thesis. He's been sitting at the desk making faces at me for the last 10 minutes.
I've been making faces because you're both doing the thing where you blame the museum for the visitor's problem. The Air and Space Museum has a 22% disappointment rate. That means 78% of visitors were satisfied. And the museum's actual mission, its legal mandate, is preservation and education, not crowd-pleasing. You're judging it by a metric it was never designed to meet.
That's fair, but 22% is still the highest among major museums. Something's going on.
Something's going on, sure. It's called tourist expectations. The Air and Space Museum gets 8 million visitors a year. Most of them are families on a Washington, D.C. trip. They're tired, they're hot, they've already done 3 museums, and the kids want to see the space stuff. They're not there for education. They're there for a photo with the lunar module. And when the lunar module is behind glass and there's a 40-minute line, they're disappointed. That's not a museum failure. That's a category error.
You're saying the survey is measuring the wrong thing.
I'm saying the survey is measuring exactly what it claims to measure, visitor sentiment. But you're treating visitor sentiment as a proxy for institutional quality, and it's not. It's a proxy for expectation alignment. A museum can be excellent at its mission and still disappoint tourists who showed up wanting a theme park.
But isn't part of the mission public engagement? If you're a public museum funded by taxpayers, don't you have some obligation to meet visitors where they are?
Some obligation, yes. But the slope from engagement to entertainment is slippery, and I'd rather have a museum that's too serious than one that's turned the Apollo program into a ride. The Air and Space Museum's problem isn't that it's bad at what it does. It's that what it does isn't what the average summer tourist wants. And I'm not sure that's a problem the museum should solve.
The Museum of the Rockies, though, that's not a tourist trap situation. You have to want to go to Bozeman. These are people who made a deliberate trip for dinosaurs.
And 21% of them were disappointed, which is not actually that high. 1 in 5. For a museum in a remote location with dated exhibits, 1 in 5 disappointed visitors strikes me as pretty good. The real story here isn't that these museums are failing. It's that the survey created a ranking that sounds damning, but actually describes institutions that satisfy the vast majority of their visitors. You're both falling for the headline.
I don't think we're falling for the headline. I think we're interested in the gap, and the gap is real even if the majority are satisfied. The reviews exist. People wrote boring and overrated and not worth it. Those are real experiences.
They're real experiences, but they're experiences of mismatch, not of institutional failure. The museum didn't fail. The visitor showed up with the wrong expectations. And I'd argue the fix isn't better exhibits, it's better visitor education. Know what you're going to see before you go. Read the website, understand that a museum isn't a movie.
I take the point about expectations, but I think the onus goes both ways. If your museum is getting a significant number of visitors who walk out feeling like they wasted their time, you can blame the visitors, or you can look at your presentation. And the best museums do both. They preserve the mission, and they think about the audience.
The best museums have the budget to do both. The Air and Space Museum has been underfunded for years. The exhibits are outdated because updating them costs millions. It's easy to say they should be more engaging. It's harder to pay for it.
So the real problem is funding, not curation.
The real problem is almost always funding, but that's a less fun episode.
He's not wrong. The survey is a useful provocation, but the deeper story is about resources. The museums that disappoint are often the ones that can't afford to evolve. They're preserving what they have with what they've got.
The earnestness we've been talking about. The curator dusting 400 ventriloquist dummies. That's not a design failure. That's someone doing the work with no budget and complete sincerity, which is maybe the most human thing about any of this.
Where does that leave us? Maybe the worst museum is the one that doesn't know it's bad, but maybe the best museum is also the one that doesn't know it's bad. It just keeps doing the work, sincerely, for whoever shows up.
The question Daniel's prompt leaves hanging is whether the earnest failure is always sad, or whether it can tip over into something enjoyable. And I think the answer is, it depends on whether you're in on the joke. The Venthaven Museum is a great experience if you go knowing it's 400 dummies in a building. It's a terrible experience if you go expecting a museum of comedy history and get 400 dummies in a building.
The expectation mismatch works both ways. Manage the expectation and the experience transforms.
As museums compete with digital experiences, with everything being a screen now, the ones that can't adapt are going to see that disappointment gap widen. The survey is a snapshot, but the trend line is what matters. Physical museums have to offer something a screen can't. If all you've got is text panels and glass cases, the phone in the visitor's pocket already does that better.
The reckoning is coming. The museums that survive will be the ones that understand what only a physical space can do. The ones that don't will keep getting 22% disappointment rates until the funding runs out.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us honest, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've ever walked out of a museum thinking that was incredibly boring and terrible, you're not alone. And now you know why. We'll be back soon.
Try the mustard. Skip the text panels.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.